All right, everyone is here. Welcome. I'll go around and say hi to everyone because most people can't see everybody. Also, I just have to give you a warning. I was in the middle of leading a 4-hour training yesterday, and my internet just died for 20 minutes. And I have fiber optic connection. I've never had this kind of problem before. It just went away. So then I hooked up by my phone. So anyway, let's just keep our fingers crossed. I just fell out of our breakout room. So yeah. If I disappear in the middle of the Dharma talk, talk amongst yourselves. I will get back to you as soon as I can using cellular service. But I will go around and say hello to David and Ellen, Marvin, So-on, Bob K, Mark W, I might as well say, you never know when the other Mark might be here, Sam, Jeannie, Susan, Matt, Mary, Amelia, Adine, Pat, Franklin, Sydney, Jim, Joe, and Lori, Vin, Bob O, Shintai, Ruth Ann, Paulette, and Shoketsu, Dawn, Sabrina, and Amanda. All kinds of people here today. All right. For announcements, there is a one-day retreat online coming up like third Saturday in August. I think it's the 22nd. And you are welcome to participate in part of that or all of that. The schedule is on the website, and it's also being put out in our newsletter. If you're going to be there for the whole thing, go ahead and register and just look at that schedule and think about how you want to participate. Let's see. It's a lovely day to... I don't know about you, but I've got a lot of stuff going on, and to set aside a whole day, I mean, it's not entirely a whole day, right? It starts at 8:30, ends at about 4. But to set aside that much time for just quiet and reflection and zazen and maybe some, you know, Dharma reading or something, but to set aside all of our usual activities and stimulation is a very sweet and valuable thing. And of course, we're all doing it together, so that's cool too. Let's see. And I guess another announcement of sorts is that if you do want to meet with me, or if we have a guest teacher during meditation for what we call Sanzen, which is Zazen together, for like five, maybe 10 minute check-in, if you have a question, want to talk about Dharma and practice, then you can sign up by sending, when the announcement happens, sending out a chat personally to me or whoever's offering Sanzen when it's announced. And then what we will do is, during the meditation period, we're offering that. So on Tuesday, that would be just the one period of meditation we have. On Sunday, it's the second period after Kinhin. So then what we're doing, we came up with a new system, which is pretty cool, where make a breakout room for each person that wants to meet with the teacher. So if there's three of you like there were today, then I made three breakout rooms and invited people to the breakout room. And then you sit in the breakout room by yourself, just waiting to meet with the teacher. So that way the teacher doesn't have to go to a breakout room, come back to the main room, create another breakout room. We just get to go from room to room. And it feels kind of like sitting in the Sanzen room and having people come in. So just be aware that if you do get invited to a breakout room for Sanzen, you might sit there by yourself for a while. And then when you're done meeting with the teacher, then on the lower right corner, you leave room to come back to this main room. And you can do that right away. All right. Any other announcements anybody can think of that should be made, that you want to make? All right. Let's hope that my internet connection lasts. So today, I want to talk about the experience of enlightenment. I'll start with a story. So this is from a book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, which has some nice stories in it. When the nun Chi Yono studied Zen under Bukko of Engaku, she was unable to attain the fruits of meditation for a long time. At last, one moonlit night, she was carrying water in an old pail bound with bamboo. The bamboo broke and the bottom fell out of the pail, and at that moment, Chiyono was set free. In commemoration, she wrote a poem. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail, since the bamboo strip was weakening and about to break. Until at last, the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail. No more moon in the water. So Kyogen mentions one of my teachers and one of Shintai's teachers. We kind of both had two teachers, right? Kyogen and Gyokuko. So they were married couple that founded Dharma Rain Zen Center. And so even though you might take one of the teachers formally, they're really both your teachers. So Kyogen mentions this poem in an essay, which I called The Paradox of Effort and Non-Effort. I'm not sure that's what he titled it himself. And I put it in this little booklet, The Basic Elements of Zen Practice, which is a compilation of essays by teachers from Dharma Rain Zen Center. And we have copies of it at our Zen Center, but we also have PDFs if anybody wants a copy from afar. So in this essay, The Paradox of Effort and Non-Effort, Kyogen says that that poem was really central to his practice at Shasta Abbey for the first several years. And
we lost her.
Yep.
Yep. Oh.
You have to give the Dharma talk now.
This happened yesterday. This happened yesterday. So something. Yeah.
The weird thing is, Domio and I have the same internet provider, and we live within 5 miles of each other. So she's experiencing something fairly local.
Maybe she had she's had Satori. She's been taken off into the Buddha realm.
I think the bottom fell out of the internet.
The internet fail.
All right, I'm back.
Yay!
I'm back via Zoom. I'm not gonna trust anything else at this point. All right. So can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah.
If I could ask everybody else to mute your mics too. And Ruth Ann, if you could mute your mic. Thank you.
If you could turn us off, then there might be more bandwidth also.
All right. Now it's going to be really, really weird to give this talk because I can only see like one person at a time. Okay, maybe three people at a time. So David, Ellen, and so on, I'm going to depend on you for like let me know if this is getting boring or not. All right. Oh, dear. So, I don't know where you lost me, but yeah, in this booklet, Kyogen talks about this poem by Chiyono being very important to him for the first several years of his practice at Shasta Monastery. So he talked about just like longing for this, for the bottom to break out of his bucket, you know, to attain awakening. And frankly, this was something that Roshi Kenneth talked about quite a lot, which is kind of atypical for Soto Zen. It's more typical in Rinzai to talk about like breaking through and awakening. So he was throwing himself, he said he was just throwing himself into his practice. Just, you know, he's at the monastery, he's living this full-time schedule, he's sitting Zazen. And he said after a year, he realized he was only wet up to his ankles. And then the next year, he's throwing himself in, and he realized he's only wet up to his knees. So he's struggling so hard. He's like a young, like 20 something guy. And said Roshi Kenneth would say frequently that in order for awakening to occur, the student has to hit bottom to get to the end of their rope. And he says this would drive him nuts because, you know, he felt like in his practice, he was getting stronger. He was learning. So like he's heading away from the bottom, right? He's not heading toward the bottom. So, but he also had to admit that there was a naturalness and ease that he recognized in the people who supposedly had done it, who supposedly had had Kensho, which means seeing your true nature. So in Zen, we talk about this as, I mean, it's not exactly enlightenment. It's the first step of enlightenment, if you will. It's the key opening to our true nature. And Kyogen realizes that awakening is not something he could do because he's trying really, really hard, right? How can he do this? So then one day, he was taking an intense, it was toward the end of an intensive 90-day practice period or ongo. And he and another monk took a grueling hike up Black Butte near Shasta Monastery in order to get some aerial photos of the monastery. And so he describes this, he's walking up a steep path, it's loose, sharp volcanic rock, he's exhausted, his boots were too big, he has a blister forming. They get to the top, they take the photos, they on the way down, you know how sometimes going back down hurts just as much as going up. So they get back to the monastery, they've missed dinner, he's got a pounding headache, he falls into bed. And in the monastery, it was okay to miss early morning Zazen if you've had a really, really rough day the day before. So he indulged himself and slept in, and he shows up at breakfast. And then here's Roshi Kenneth praising this other monk who'd been in the Zendo that morning. This other monk who, despite everything he had to do the day before, he was in the Zendo that morning, first thing. She said, "Now there's a monk who really wants the practice." And Kyogen was furious, thinking about how he's like, what else is he supposed to do? He's opened his veins for this practice and for the monastery, and now someone else is better just because he missed one sitting period. So then he says, and I will just read Kyogen's words. He says, "I don't remember exactly what happened next, but I do remember burying my face in my hands. I felt empty in a numb sort of way, thinking, what the hell is the point? Roshi asked me what was going on, pressuring me, and said, I said, there's just no love here. What I meant was that I felt completely unseen. That's what I felt. At that point, she got up and walked across the room and looked into my eyes, muttered, and went back to her seat.
About then, breakfast arrived and the bell was struck. The other monks hadn't made it down from where they were doing the morning cleaning, so it was just the two of us and one other monk in the refectory. I sat there staring down at my bowls. She said to me, "Kyogen, look up." I said, "I thought, yeah, right. I'd heard that before." She said, "No, I mean it. Look up." So I straightened up a bit, but kept looking down at the table. To me, this meant, come on now, look on the bright side, be cheerful, be a good little monk, and do everything with a bright, shiny face. I thought, oh. She said, "Listen to me. Open up your hands, palm upward, and look up." She came around behind me and took my hands and turned them over. I turned my gaze upward, and kaboom. I was overwhelmed by release and affirmation. I won't try to describe it all, but I ended up under the table, laughing my fool head off. So, what did Kyogen experience? What is awakening? The idea of enlightenment has been central to Buddhism since the beginning. Sometimes it's called liberation, sometimes it's called awakening, but it all pretty much means the same thing. So Shakyamuni, it all started with, practice as intensely as any person ever could, according to our story and mythology, for 6 years, and then had an experience that gave him what he sought, or that he achieved what he had been looking for. So this is from the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta, number 36. So he describes his process of awakening, which was extensive. He realized this, and then he saw this, and whatever. So this is toward the end, and he said, he gains insight into the Four Noble Truths, and he says, "Then my heart, thus knowing, thus seeing, was released from the fermentation of sensuality, released from the fermentation of becoming, released from the fermentation of ignorance. With release, there was the knowledge released. I discerned that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done." So from what we can tell, this is a moment of understanding. But, you know, beyond, of course, just the intellectual. A moment of comprehension, a moment of seeing, of experience of knowing. And afterwards, Siddhartha is called a Buddha, or an awakened one. And according to our stories, was never again troubled spiritually by anything, but displayed immense generosity, diligence, compassion, and taught for 45 years. So in our Zen tradition, of course, we have many similar stories. And one of the most central is that of our fifth ancestor in the Platform Sutra, Hui Neng. So here's his brief little story. Hui Neng's stern father was originally from Fan Yang. He was banished to Xin Shu in Lingnan, where he became a commoner. Unfortunately, his father soon died, and his aging mother was left alone. They moved to Nanhai, and poor and in bitter straits, Hui Neng sold wood in the marketplace. Once a customer bought firewood and ordered it delivered to his shop. When the delivery had been made and Hui Neng was receiving the money, he went outside the gate where he noticed a customer reciting a sutra. Upon once hearing the words of this sutra, one should produce that thought which is nowhere supported. Hui Neng's mind immediately opened to enlightenment. So at this point of enlightenment, Hui Neng is an illiterate young man, completely uneducated, not a monk. As far as we know, hadn't sought Zazen, hadn't practiced Buddhism. I mean, later he did. I mean, he's our sixth ancestor in the Zen lineage, because he did end up, you know, immersing himself in the Zen lineage. But this this experience of enlightenment was not dependent on any of that. So looking more closely at the experience of enlightenment, what happens? What is it people awaken to? What does that awakening feel like? Why is it positive? Why is it important? So this is a description of a woman's experience after Kensho, after practicing in the Rinzai tradition. So this is from Philip Kaplow's book, Three Pillars of Zen. And this is, he calls, this is Mrs. D.K., a Canadian housewife, age 35. So this is after she sits a really intensive session working on a koan. So she has gone to the Roshi and presented her understanding, which is not something you can read and go like, oh, I see what she understood. That it's, you know, there was communication and the Roshi said, yes, you've seen. So this is what she follows up with. So too stiff and tired to continue sitting, I slipped quietly from the main hall and returned to the bathhouse for a second bath. Never before had the road been so road-like. The shops, such perfect shops. Nor the winter sky, so unutterably a starry sky. Joy bubbled up like a fresh spring. The days and weeks that followed were the most deeply happy and serene of my life. There was no such thing as a problem. Things were either done or not done, but in any case, there was no worry nor consternation. Past relationships to people which had once caused me deep disturbance, I now saw with perfect understanding. For the first time in my life, I was able to move like the air, in any direction, free at last from the self which had always been such a tormenting bond to me. So this kind of description, of course, along with our anticipation of the ego boost that would we assume would happen when our enlightenment, when we're officially enlightened, our enlightenment is officially recognized by a Zen teacher, it definitely encourages us to objectify this experience. Enlightenment becomes an attainment that some people get and some don't. Perhaps we long for it, secretly envy it. Maybe we think we deserve it after all the effort we've put in, or because of our particular spiritual strengths and insights. Perhaps we're determined and we vow to attain it. Or maybe we conclude we're not capable of it, and we need to settle for less. You know, a little less stress, a little more acceptance, a little more compassion and wisdom and equanimity. Or maybe we conclude that enlightenment is BS and has nothing to do with our practice. It's just a myth that some poor sods fall for. But enlightenment awakening is very real, and it's absolutely central to Buddhism. Enlightenment means knowing the truth. And in this case, we're not just talking about some limited truth. We're talking about the truth of our life. Waking up to the truth of our life is not only an end in and of itself, it also results in the kind of joy and freedom described earlier. But it's helpful if we stop viewing enlightenment, or we never from the first view enlightenment in a dualistic binary way, but more as an opening up, a deepening of intimacy, a widening of perspective, an increasing willingness to let go of our mental map of reality, a growing familiarity with things as it is, And sometimes this opening, deepening, widening, increasing willingness, growing familiarity is experienced in fits and starts. Sometimes there is a relatively dramatic insight or opening or transformation. But most of the time this happens gradually, even imperceptibly, like getting wet by walking in the mist. So yesterday when I was preparing for this talk, I just, I have in my office, like a pretty expansive Buddhist and Zen library. And I just pulled a bunch of books off the shelf and then I was taking a break and I went to go sit somewhere else in a comfy spot with this pile of books and just to look at what each one said about enlightenment and just kind of pull them all together. But obviously I had a little bit of memory of each of these that they said something intriguing. So this is from Charlotte Joko Beck in Everyday Zen in a chapter called Pushing for Enlightenment Experiences. And some of you may remember this, but many of you probably don't. Early on in kind of convert Zen in America, there was a lot of emphasis, particularly because most of the initial groups were Rinzai. There was a lot of pushing for enlightenment. And people got really hardcore. Like they just like, focus on mu every second of every day and like really pushing themselves and like die on the cushion. And so they were really pushing for this, which is like, I don't know, culturally Zen has changed so much. It's kind of like, it's really, so it's kind of anachronism in a way to read this chapter about pushing for enlightenment experiences when like it's not really the problem anymore, but if you can kind of put yourself into that, imagine that that's the situation she's talking about, that people are pushing for these enlightenment experiences. And she's recommending against it. And so what she says is that let's start first with the, what is it we're going for? Let's imagine what that's like. What does a Buddha look like? What does an awakened person look like? And she says, for this fully enlightened and perhaps hypothetical being, because she says, I don't know that anybody's actually ever attained this completely, maybe a few people. For this fully enlightened being, there would be no boundaries. There would be nothing in the universe about which such a being could not say, without qualification, Namu Dai Bosa, unite with great united being, great enlightened being. You and I cannot truly say this for everything. All we can do is extend our ability to do so. But a Buddha would be one who could say that, who could be united without barrier or boundaries with everything in the universe. Now, before such complete enlightenment, there's a state of a fully integrated person. Of course, for this person, there are still boundaries, limitations, so there is some place where that integration fails. Nonetheless, that's what you might call mind-body integration, wonderful and rare. Most of us are in some of the stages leading up to that, which means we cannot own even our own bodies completely. Any tension in the body means that we cannot own it. We won't say that we are a body, but that we have a body. And then there's a state before that, when we completely disown the body, thinking we're just a mind. And there's a state before that in which we cannot even own even all of our own mind. We split off some of that as well. Depending on what our conditioning is right now, we can see just so much. We can embrace just so much. The last state I mentioned is so constricted, so narrow, that anything introduced beyond it is fearsome. If introduced too soon, it's devastating. And this is where we encounter many of the odd and even harmful effects of practice. For this constricted person, the universe looks like a little pinpoint of light. Introduce a light as bright as the sun, and the person may go crazy, and sometimes does. So she's arguing, and in a way that I agree, that that pushing people, kind of like a Buddhist boot camp, kind of pushing people, you know, kind of like to break them down in order to build them back up thing is, you know, it's has been on occasion fruitful. But it also can be damaging. Because you, like you're saying, like you are we're pushing ourselves to break open our minds in a way that perhaps we haven't built up the practice and the maturity and the integration to actually deal with. I mean, there's part of me, if I had heard that argument early on in practice, I'd been like, I don't care, you know, like bring it on, break me down. But actually, I think Kyogen would talk about this in terms of when we're talking about like these, whether our opening is really gradual, said kind of like a lotus flower that's just, you know, opening a petal at a time, or whether it kind of bam, it just blossoms in an instant, that some of this has to do with, you know, has to do with our personal karma, our minds and bodies, our perhaps our history of past trauma, that you know, each of us is going to respond to this practice differently. And I felt for myself that I never had a, you know, dramatic knockdown, drag out enlightenment experience. And I think perhaps in part that was because I have a very, very, very healthy and resilient mind. I felt like my mind would like, let me see just a little bit more, and then be like, that's enough. That's enough. Let's, okay, that's an insight. Go integrate it. That's it. like Kyogen, I wanted that bottom to fall out of my bucket, but that just didn't happen. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't opening, there wasn't growth, there wasn't expansion happening there. So I like Joko Beck's description of that, you know, going from a really constricted life, which I'm guessing that most of us have experienced at least in part of our lives, or perhaps still experience to some extent, of just feeling kind of, you know, small and disconnected and limited, and that gradually, you know, we expand that sense. So enlightenment is not a one-time deal, and it doesn't necessarily have to happen suddenly or dramatically. Perhaps when there's less blockage, things flow more naturally and, right, very gradual. So, but even though this is so, we still have to keep up the effort. So this is what we haven't been chanting it lately, but we will soon. In our morning service, the Precious Mirror Samadhi lines, this is what in part they are about. So we say, the Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, preserve it well. A silver bowl filled with snow, a heron hidden in the moon. Taken as similar, they are not the same, not distinguished, their places are known. The meaning does not reside in the words, but a pivotal moment brings it forth. So just like Kyogen's like, turn your hands up, or Chiyono's bucket falling apart, pivotal moment brings it forth. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like massive fire. So I like that last line, but in some ways I kind of like the translation from Shasta Abbey that Kyogen and Gyokuko trained with, and that some of us who were around Dharma Rain for a long time, we chanted this for a while before we changed the translation. So this last line then is, this is as if a giant fireball. Never come too close, nor put yourself too far away. I like the giant fireball. So if the truth we are seeking, if this experience is like a giant fireball, if we go too far away, we'll lose it, we're cold. If we try to grasp it, we'll get burned. and the, you know, metaphors fall apart, but if we try to grasp, you know, make that bottom fall out of our bucket through sheer force of will, it actually doesn't work. Everything gets kind of warped. On the other hand, if we just walk away and we say, oh, you know, if you just try, you try to grasp it. I mean, enlightenment, you can't really get your mind around it. So, you know, who cares? That doesn't really work either. So how do we do this? We make great effort while knowing our effort in and of itself will not bring about enlightenment. This is exactly what that poem by Chiyono talks about. In this way, I tried to save the old pail, since the bamboo strip was weakening and about to break, until at last the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail, no more moon in the water. So our effort, our zazen, our precept work, our karma work, our work with relationships, our study, our exploration of the Dharma together, this is like binding the pail. And Kyogen in his essay also talks about like trying to throw everything you can into the bucket. Everything you can, put it all in there, and you're trying to bind this pail. It's the only thing that we can do. Can't, I mean, this is just a metaphor, right? So it doesn't work, actually, to just bust the bucket out of the bottom of the pail. In a way, that would be like us saying, well, I heard Chiyono was enlightened when she was carrying a bucket and the bottom fell out. So let me see. Let's get this bucket and put some water in it. And then, you know, let's make the bottom fall out. Like, that's not our moment, right? That's not actually going to work. So we can't force this to happen, and yet we can create the conditions for it. So Kyogen talks about in this essay as well about there being an understanding in Japan that there's an important relationship between Pure Land and Zen. Pure Land being other power Buddhism, where you pray to Amida Buddha with sincerity, you repeat his name, and then the idea is that after death you are reborn in the Western paradise where it's easy to gain enlightenment. And Zen, of course, is like self-power. We're going to meditate, we're going to try to die on the cushion, we're going to try to achieve this insight. So this idea is that if you want to really get where you're going, if you enter through other power, you have to leave through self-power. It's really not just about it being about, because like the description of Pure Land Buddhism is if you recite Amida's name with like pure trust and love and sincerity. So that's the catch, right? How do you do that? How do you do that with that pure love and sincerity? So then you have work to do. And then by the self-power piece, when you recognize there's something beyond that involved, you're not going to be able to make this happen through sheer force of will. So in a way, it's that other power piece. Even if you don't have to conceive of what that other power is, you don't have to deify it or personify it, but it is not you. So Kyogen talks about this effort that we make. He said, it takes this effort to penetrate to your own heart. The effort of binding the pail. Before we understand what no effort really is. We can understand this in small ways in daily life. I think all of us have. Have you experienced trying and trying and trying something and then stepped back and relaxed a minute and then the answer has come? That is a moment of non-effort. A small example of the same principle. We chew away on a problem and then just take a day off. The next day, the answer comes easily. The same principle applies in a lot of different ways, but it also applies to this major cycle of our relationship to practice and the Dharma. So have you experienced any enlightenment? And we try not to consider this from a dualistic perspective. In a way, it is wrong whether we say yes or no. If we say yes, then we're probably, you know, objectifying it. On Tuesday, I had this insight into da-da-da. But on the other hand, if we say no, that's really probably not true. Have we experienced opening up? A deepening of intimacy? A widening of perspective? An increasing willingness to let go of our mental map of reality? A growing familiarity, comfort, knowledge with things as it is? I'll bet you have. Do you want to experience more? Have you committed yourself to continuing this process of enlightenment for the rest of your life? And how do you know whether what you've experienced is what we would call enlightenment in Buddhism? You can know and you can't know. You can know at a level that you can't grasp or express. So one of the books that I picked up was this compilation of essays, Roar of the Tigress by Roshi Kennett. And she has lots of stuff to say. This is just a little bit of it. So she often calls the that which we are seeking to awaken to is the unborn. This isn't a chapter, it is enough to know the unborn. And it's a lecture on Dogen's essay, Shin Fukatoku, The Mind Cannot Be Grasped. So she says, Shin Fukatoku, which is usually translated as the mind cannot be grasped, could be translated as the heart or Buddha nature cannot be grasped. In other words, we cannot know, we cannot weigh, we cannot understand our true heart or Buddha nature. I think that Buddha nature is a lot better term than heart, and certainly than soul, but the point is, it can be experienced. It can be known, but it cannot be held onto. Dogen's famous metaphor of putting one's hand into the water and feeling the water flow through one's fingers is highly applicable here. You cannot take your hand out of the water and hope to hold on to a handful of it. But when you have your hand in the water, you know what water is as it flows past. And for the true trainee, it is enough to know Buddha nature. It does not need to be grasped, held on to, or attached to. All these highfalutin philosophical words like attachment and non-attachment all sound so wonderful. But what matters is that it is enough to know Buddha nature. It is enough to know the unborn. Don't try to hold on to it. Don't try to grasp it. Just let it flow and be content. So I'll leave it there. Comments or questions? I will not be able to see anyone raise their hand, so please just go ahead and unmute yourself if you have something you want to say. Looks like David, you unmuted yourself.
I did. I just want to make sure I understood or grasped correctly the comment you made maybe 10 minutes ago. Something like enlightenment is being able to engage the whole world without boundaries. Is that close to what you said?
Yeah, that's the way that Joko Beck described it. Yeah.
I just from my own personal place, that will never happen. I mean, it's just it's inconceivable that I would ever arrive at a place where I could do that.
But can you extend the boundaries that you have?
Oh, I think, yeah. I mean, if I have any ability at all to directly experience, it is on those rare occasions when I'm able to focus to such a degree that I forget who I am, or I forget any sense of myself. And for me, most of the time, it's when I'm doing something outdoors, walking or whatever. And so, I mean, it's not, to a very large degree, maybe entirely, I don't have the ability to put into words and to explain what it is like to be in that kind of a state. It is ineffable by its very nature, it seems to me. And I'm sure there are lots of other folks who are way better than I am at trying to get at that.
Well, seeing as that none of the ancestors were able to do it either. I mean, they were more enlightened than we are, and they tried. But, you know, nothing that is written from the time of the Buddha until now can we read and attain enlightenment. That it was so simple, right? We can't. And yet, because even though we cannot grasp it or put words to it or convey it, we can know it in that sense of, like, you know, even if you don't always have your hand in the water, you know what that's like. You know the reality of water. And you are a different person because of it. You are, everything is different because you know what that is.
Yeah. My feeling is there is no way to render direct experience in such a manner that whomever one might be addressing is going to participate in what that direct experience is. I mean, it just seems it's of a nature that it's ineffable.
Mm-hmm. And yet we somehow manage to communicate with one another somehow, right? Sure. I mean, we're pointing to the moon. We can't give each other the moon, but we can point to it. And sometimes, I mean, if nobody had been pointing at the moon, I never would have looked. And poetry. I mean, you love poetry. It's like sometimes something is evoked or conveyed that, you know, and I guess it comes down to the fact that we do share experience.
Yes. Yes.
The one way to share, this is Bob, one way to share is to talk about it. But there's another kind of sharing that goes on that is more like Dharma interview. Or I'm not exactly sure what to say there, but there's another kind of sharing where whatever you've experienced becomes part of you. I want to use the term embodied. It becomes embodied. So the energy that happened to you or whatever gets embodied in you. And then you have a way of expressing it. And there are many ways to express it without talking about it. But also on the receiver side or the viewer's side, it's like, well, you also have to be not sensitized, but you have to be sensitive enough to be able to perceive that energy and that, you know, so that it doesn't actually require a lot of words to talk about. Because I always get totally befuddled when I try to describe something. It's too hard. It's yeah. Like, well, you know me, I like to laugh. I like to joke.
Yeah, you're reminding me of the our Zen version of the Dharma transmission of Maka Kasho from Shakyamuni. Shakyamuni, you just, he looks out over the assembly of all these thousands of disciples, and he is basically like, well, okay, folks, what do you understand? And then he like holds up a flower, and Makakasho smiles. And, you know, when I imagine that, I just, you know, there's a background there, right? But maybe there doesn't even have to be. Maybe there's, you know, a communication that happens. You're in the grocery store and somebody just like, you know, is looking at an apple, looks at you, and there's something communicated there about here we are.
Yes. I agree. The more, you know, the more I try to explain things to people, especially people who are not practicing as we are trying to practice, but people who have quite different political views and health views and things like that, the more I try to explain things, the more I find out that the barriers kind of grow up, get in place. It kind of creates barriers because I am factualizing things that either they already know about or they don't agree with, you know, and it's, there's something else besides that we can use or that we can touch people with. It doesn't have to be like that. And I think that's learning how to touch people or reach people that way, I think, is one of the tenets of my practice. Is like, let's not go factual, let's not go logical.
I like it.
I thought I would just throw this out there for anyone. There's actually a really fascinating kind of, I don't think it's a current movement, it still exists, but I think it grew up around medieval Zen in Japan, called wabi-sabi, and it's very much kind of what people are describing in this idea of the viewer would look at a piece of art, and it wouldn't even have to be an art object, it could be an everyday object like a teacup, and it wouldn't even have to be a beautiful teacup, but it somehow, the ability to see the beauty of the teacup was dependent upon the viewer and the viewer's sensitivity and their relationship to the teacup. And I've always thought that was such an interesting idea, such a different approach to art from the West, where we think of, you know, you have to paint a beautiful painting to capture the viewer's attention and reach out to them. And it's such a different way of looking at communication and non-verbal communication. So I think if people are interested in that idea, maybe look into that history of wabi-sabi in Japan. And if I remember correctly, it's spelled literally wabi/sabi. Because it is really intriguing. It's entirely different way of looking at how we communicate really deep sentiment in non-verbal ways, especially between not even people, but inanimate objects and people.
Are you sure you're not talking about some green hot paste that you put on sushi? What?
That's wasabi.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I got a master's degree in art history, so I'm pretty sure I got it right, although my spelling might be wrong.
It's close.
Yeah, it is close.
Wasabi. Wabi-sabi. I think
being a wise guy.
I think wise guy. Our leg.
Well, if I may.
Don't tell.
Yeah.
Don't tell me you guys didn't think of that.
Wabi-sabi wasabi. It's a new brand. Well, you know, we hear these stories about becoming one with everything. What is it, the Buddha at the hot dog vendor? Make me one with everything. You know, and from my perspective, it's just a lot more mundane than it's set out to be. Though it's not any less astonishing, I suppose. I looked this up. It's this the Sutra on Totality. It's in the Pali Canon, the Samyutta Nikaya, and the Buddha is saying, "What monks is totality. It is just the eye with the objects of sight, the ear with the objects of hearing, the nose with the objects of smell, the tongue with the objects of taste, the body with the objects of touch, and the mind with the objects of cognition. This, monks, is called totality. Now, if anyone were to say, aside from this explanation of totality, I will preach another totality, that person would be speaking empty words, and being questioned would not be able to answer. Why is this? Because that person is talking about something outside of all possible knowledge. So that's it, you know, from my little point of view. That's it. I mean, that whole no separation between the self and the objects of the world is just what I'm seeing right now is really an image that's in my brain and is, you know, like, you know, they say in your eye, it turns it upside down. It's upside down. And then your brain flips it right side up. And that's really that's all that's possible for me to experience. And that is the sum totality of my visual experience and my auditory experience. It's my eardrum that's moving. So that it's not a sound, is not some external thing. It is my eardrum that is moving. And, you know, that's kind of a materialistic way of looking at that. But to me, it's no less spiritual and it's no less profound. I don't know. I really don't know how else to experience it or to explain it, you know. But another thing that I thought of was Kyogen, when talking about this mind blowing enlightenment experience, you know, when talking to me about it, he said people who have a good practice and are less, who have worked through a lot of their delusions, or they're just not naturally very deluded people, is more like people who are walking through that mist and they become wet over time, you know. But somebody who's really screwed up and deluded, like me, you know, having an enlightenment experience is more like, you know, just dumping a bucket of water on somebody, and that's how they get wet. And so it's not like, oh, you've had this grand experience, and so you must be more enlightened because you had this big bam kind of experience. But it's more like, no, you're just way more deluded than other people. So you went from way back here to over here, whereas that person was here and went over here. You see what I mean? Yeah, I miss him more every day. Yeah, he just had a real practical way and humorous way of explaining these things. And also, thank you for talking about this, because it really isn't Soto Zen. It's really something that's like, ooh, we don't talk about it, you know. And but people do experience it, and people who think they can't experience it do experience it. And what was it? Roshi Kennett said, you should keep change in your pocket in case you're out and about and you have Kensho and you need to go to a payphone and call. Back when there were payphones, you need to call a friend when you have Kensho.
and it's, I think there are strengths and weaknesses of every spiritual and religious tradition. And one of the weaknesses of Rinzai is that it will objectify enlightenment experiences too much and get people too wound up and too competitive and too aggressive and too blah, blah, blah. But one of the weaknesses of Soto is that we say, we're not gonna do that. You can't grasp this. And so we kind of forget that enlightenment exists at all. So that's why they're kind of like two sides of the same coin, you know? They've existed side by side to liven each other up. So it's important that, like, the Enlightenment experiences in some dramatic, identifiable way are not important, but enlightenment is the essence of our practice. So I'll leave it there.
Are we out of time?
Yes, we are.
Oh darn.
So I'll just do our closing verse here. We offer the merit of this practice together to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, go get enlightened now.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Domio.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.